Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Tonight, our speaker will be Les. I think most of you know Les K, our abbot. And he will be talking on the transient nature of values.
Happy to see you all, even though we all look like a postage stamp. I hope we are not forever stamps. Well, as Bonnie mentioned, I'd like to explore with you a little bit what we call our values. Usually our relationship to the things and to the people and to the events of this world are based on what we call our values. And values are the ideas and the feelings that we feel are very true, and we hold them very close, our values. They do provide our minds with a stability and a certain guidance in a very complex world. But values, although they seem quite firm, are not indestructible, and they are not independent. You know, our personal values are products of our education and of the beliefs that we pick up from our culture and our society, as well as the lessons and the teachings that we received at a very early age. And values, we carry them around in the back of our mind. And values may be constructive or they may not. And without the work of reflection and exploration and an open mind, what I mean is without an honest testing of our values, they can prove to be unreliable, because values can change tomorrow. As our public opinion changes, and as the tastes of the world change, and as we ourselves acquire more experiences, our values may change. So as we mature and grow wiser, our values may not be what they used to be. Although they may feel very true in the given moment, and they also may change tomorrow. As an example, one example of how values can change. In today's world, today's culture, intimate relationships between unmarried men and women are accepted without protest. Nobody makes a fuss anymore about that. But for most of human history, till maybe the last 150 years, this was a very serious social offense. Relationships between men and women who were not married. And one example out of one very vivid example is portrayed in the novel The Scarlet Letter by Hawthorne. Does anybody know The Scarlet Letter? Know that book? Hawthorne lived in the 19th century. That novel was written in 1850, and it tells about a village in Massachusetts in the year 1667. And briefly, a woman of the town and the minister get together, and she becomes pregnant. This is in 1667. the townspeople find out and are shocked. And she becomes shamed. She is forced to wear an A on her clothing, a red A, the scarlet letter, A for adulteress. She is shamed, and he faces prison. Prison. And she also faces possible imprisonment because they had an affair. Today's values have a totally different view of these relationships between men and women. No longer do we make a fuss about it. Today's values about that kind of relationship is much different than it has been for centuries. So what is the real truth? What is the truth? When we come to feel that our lives are influenced too much by the changing values of the world we live in, we want to know what's real. That's one of the reasons we come to practice. We sense that the values that people hold and that we hold, everybody's got a different set of values, it seems, and we don't know what's real. It's quite confusing. We want to know what's real because we want to live an authentic life. We don't want to live a deluded life. We don't want to be continually misled by the forces of some transient social opinions, as well as our own changing understanding. Our hearts and minds want to reflect what is authentic and not just what seems true in the moment. Our minds become anxious when it feels constrained by conditions placed on it by society or by our home or by our culture. And we seek freedom from this sense of constraint. This freedom requires a journey, a process of self-exploration, and that's what our practice is all about. A process of self-exploration so that we can discover reality for ourselves and not stand still intellectually by what is comfortable or what are the prevailing values. In the Zen world, you know, a teacher is not considered a true teacher based on his or her particular charisma or particular charm or brilliant intellect. A true teacher is a travel guide. A true teacher hints at what we should look for. And this looking, this process of looking, is itself our practice. For example, in the Genjo Koan, Dogen says, depending on the viewpoint, we see worldly things in different ways. Correct perception depends on the amount of study and practice. And Suzuki Roshi said, to understand reality from our own experience is why we practice. So what is this thing called reality that we seek for? Well, we know that it is not some transient or temporary values of the the material world or of our emotional world. Reality is the unchanging nature of our true self. So we practice. We practice to express our spiritual nature in all of our activities. And in our daily life, when our choices become difficult, when they become confusing, when we don't know how to choose, we need to return to our spiritual foundation. This is our practice. Most people return to their values. But for us, we return to our spiritual foundation so that we can make decisions that we feel are authentic and not just easy and not just expedient or politically correct. If we don't return to our spiritual foundation to seek out our decisions, they will feel artificial. But to do this, it requires some courage, you know, because we may have to yield something of our relative world if we want to go back to our spiritual foundation. If we want to make a decision from our spiritual heart, we may have to give up something from the material world. But this decision will be authentic, and it will bring us confidence. So when we return to our spiritual self, we are performing a ritual. The form of this ritual is not verbal, nonverbal, simply sitting and performing a ceremony. Nonverbal. And when we do it, we are expressing something very great, something beyond our temporary self. For example, I've heard it said that when we bow, when we do full prostrations in our ceremonies, it is like returning to the earth, returning to the earth, returning to the ground of our authenticity, where nothing is artificial. And when somebody says that someone else is down to earth, they are paying them the greatest compliment. They are saying that person is not artificial. That person is trustworthy. So our practice is a journey. A journey of discovery. Our practice is how we make discoveries of the nature of things that is beyond preconception. Or in other words, beyond the propaganda of the day. But the truth about discoveries is that they are not something new. Discoveries are actually something remembered, something that we have forgotten or have failed to recognize. This is a very key point in our Zazen practice. We remember, we don't discover. There's a saying that everybody is familiar with, that an elephant never forgets. The elephant is a symbol of not forgetting. and is an important symbol in Buddhism. Most of you know the legend of the story of Buddha's birth. The story goes that when the baby Buddha was conceived, his mother, the Queen Maya, went to her tent, to her quarters, to rest. She fell asleep and she had a very vivid dream. And in this dream, four angels carried her high into the mountains and clothed her in flowers. A white male elephant appeared, bearing a white lotus in its trunk. The elephant approached Buddha's mother and walked around her three times. It struck her in the right side with its trunk, and he vanished into her. It's quite a vivid story. So when Buddha was born, he was already endowed with the purity and the wisdom of the elephant. The elephant is the symbol of our original spiritual nature and is the unlimited knowledge of authentic truth. So Buddha's experiences and his insights and his teachings are not about attaining something new. He's not sharing with us something new. He is sharing with us something that he already knows. And we are discovering what we already know. We remember our truths through the empty mind, through the mind that is empty of mundane distractions. This is our practice. So the Buddha gave us teachings, and he gave us this practice, and he encouraged us to discover what we already know. So our practice is the process of remembering who we are. Our practice is how we return to our authentic self. When we read a scripture, Buddhist scripture, or a teaching, or hear a lecture, we may feel, oh, that's interesting, that's something new, I'm glad I heard that. Actually, our attitude should be, oh, I remember that. Thanks for reminding me. I think many of you were present last Saturday to hear the talk by Troy Williams. Troy, as many of you will remember or know, grew up in Southern California in Compton, a very difficult place for a young boy to grow up. He joined a gang at a very early age, barely a teenager, he joined a gang for protection. As he explained, anybody who was not in a gang back then was subject to attack by all the gangs. You had to belong to a gang to have protection. So he joined a gang, became what he continually referred to himself as a gangbanger. But after a few years of being in the gang, he got into trouble. And he went to San Quentin. Fortunately, there was a meditation program at San Quentin. Some people from the San Francisco Zen Center would go to San Quentin a few times a week to teach meditation. And Troy became involved in meditation, and it had a major impact on his life. So he talked about one experience he had when he was put in solitary confinement for something that he said he did not do. And he was very upset at his situation. Solitary confinement is quite unpleasant, and he was to be in there for, what did he say, 30 days. And he said to himself, how did I get here? What has it been in my life that brought me to this place in solitary confinement, known as a criminal, persecuted by police and by gangs? How did all this happen? So he made a list. He made a list of all the things that he could think of that brought him to his place, the place in life where he was. So he listed the police and the way they were, and if only they had treated him a little differently when he was younger, he might not be here. He listed his parents, who didn't give him the support that he needed. He listed the school system. He made a long list of all the things and people who he felt, you know, let him down and brought him to his point in life. And he told us, he said, when he looked at the list, he thought to himself, there's something missing. This list is not complete. There's something wrong here. I've got to find out what that missing element is. And he said to himself, I'm going to start over. I'm going to start this list over again. And so he said, the next morning, he started over again. The first thing that came to his mind was the missing element, himself. And he started thinking about his own role in bringing him to the place in life that he was at. So he made this discovery. I'm confident he remembered his own role in the process of his life, thanks to his meditation practice, thanks to his Zazen practice. It opened his mind to be receptive to something that had been hidden and buried. The spirit of our practice should be, what else will I remember? The orientation of our mind should be prepared to remember. Our mind, this is not the same orientation of a mind that is hoping to attain something from Zazen practice. What am I going to remember? In our tradition, Before a lecture or before a sermon, before a talk, we do three bows and we chant a vow to remind us to be selfless. All of our forms are rituals. They are reminders to continue our mindfulness and to drop off mental propaganda so that we can discover who we really are. Buddha's great insight was that everybody is inherently Buddha, that we are already enlightened. We are already endowed with wisdom, thanks to that elephant we are carried through our life by our Buddha nature, by the pure and the steady and the wise elephant. The ride may be bumpy in our life, but we will have the capacity to remember who we are beyond the values of our everyday lives. So I have a question for you. But let me give you another example of how values can change. And we can all recognize this. Once in a while, some politician will say, I'm no longer a Republican, I am now a Democrat. Or I'm no longer a Democrat, now I am a Republican. Which kind of says my values are different. That's another example. So my question for you is, can any of you think of a value in your life that has changed? And how did that happen? So think for a moment. What value, if any, in your life has changed over the years? Somehow you feel differently about something than you did in earlier years. Does anybody have an example of how a value has changed for them? Tough question. You really have to think hard.
I can think of a lot of them, but I want to let someone else go. So.
Oh, don't be shy.
I see Travis. All right, Travis, go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, I think about values a lot. So, thank you for the question. I think it has a lot to do with identity and, you know, my sense of identity shifting with time. I think when we start off as children, we have a smaller sense of the world. And so what he said about going beyond everyday values, I think that really resonates with me and the ways that values can change with your experience. The journey to discover who we really are, and that's our life. That's a lifelong project, I think. And you know, so I get very very curious, but also very sensitive, and I'm very careful about what I take in, what kind of news I read, and really try to think about, you know, my long-term trajectory, where I want to go. And I think this time is an opportunity to do some of that. So yeah, I think it's identity. Identity, my values about where I fit in and how I see myself relating to the world.
Anna?
I think one example I have is I think I used to really value politeness and manners. And with time, I realized that different cultures express that in different ways. So I've changed my thinking to valuing kindness and not worrying so much about manners. I try to be polite, but realizing that everyone expresses that in different ways. So I think more about kindness instead of that. So that's one way I've changed my values. Okay.
Thank you. Do you have any sense of how that value evolved and how it changed?
I think with experience, probably one reason I was so focused on politeness was because I was taught that. And then I didn't want to be unkind. And I was taught that one way of doing that was to be polite. And I probably had anxiety around it, which was one reason it was so present in my mind. And then with time, I realized that there's lots of ways to express that, and it's not always clear. And so it was just learning. I'm learning that, and I think my practice made it helpful to see that coming up in my mind often enough that I was aware of it.
Okay, good. Thank you. That's very nice. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to go. There's a lot of things I can think of, but there's one in particular. I got married very young. I was only married for a couple of years. And I was raised in a particular religion where you do not divorce, you know? It's like, you know, maybe you'll kill each other, but you'll never divorce each other. It's supposed to be. And everyone told me, so my husband and I, my husband and I were planning on, we were not happy. Neither of us were happy. And everyone was telling us that divorce was going to make us miserable. And it's like, you're going through life maimed and you're always missing that part of your soul. And you're just like, it's like an unforgivable sin. And so after we divorced, I kept waiting for the depression to hit in. Like sooner or later, it's just going to hit me and I'm going to be so sad and miss. And it never happened. I was so happy. I started going dancing every Friday night at Cheryl Burke. I made a whole lot of friends. I started doing writing retreats with Natalie, and it's like my life blossomed. And I realized that I didn't fit the mold. You know, I was conditioned and told that being married is going to make you happy, but not that marriage is a bad thing. I think it works out great for some people, but just, you know, like what I was told was going to make me happy didn't make me happy. And same with him. So we were both ultimately happier after we split. So I think it was about learning to trust myself rather than trust what other people said would make me happy.
Good. Thank you. Thank you.
Columbine and then Dave.
For me, I can't think of many values. The one thing that I can think of is just how I relate to my family. So when I was younger, I think I had a strong sense of wanting to be seen. And if I wasn't seen, I had a hard time putting things under the rug, maybe with certain family members. My dad is a lot more wanting people to get along, even if they don't. There have been things that have come up in the past, but now that I'm older, I'm more like my dad in the sense that I just want everyone to kind of have a kind of copacetic relationship, and just, it doesn't have to be a super deep relationship, but as long as we're all kind of getting along and seeing each other from time to time, there's value in that. That's just, I don't know if that's a value change, but I've definitely changed my perspective on that getting older.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we have Dave and then May.
I guess in some sense, I want to echo something that's a little bit the other way around from what Columbine said. There's one way, at least, in which I think I've become less like my father. And this is not in any way to denigrate him. He was a very, very kind and thoughtful man. But I think both from him and from the society that I grew up in the middle of the 20th century, I came to value quite strongly a certain kind of masculine strength, not the kind of thing that dominates women as much as values and protects them and tries to take care of them. And this is certainly the way my father saw his role relative to my mother. And I think I picked up that same kind of feeling about how men should relate to women. And it took me a long time to really come to terms with the fact that I had to manifest a nurturing and kind and vulnerable side, and I had to respect in women the kind of strength and autonomy that I had mostly attributed to the masculine, to the male role in society. So I think that's a value that has really changed for me, is to not value even the noblest forms of this sort of masculinity, but to see the two sexes in a much more subtle and nuanced kind of way in their interactions with each other.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Dave. Brenda? Oh, wait, sorry. I said May first and then Brenda, sorry. Go ahead, May.
In terms of value, there's actually been significant change recently. You know, I actually grew up pretty much my life right now split half and half in China and America. It's interesting. And then originally the reason I want to came to the United States is like, you know, the Asian culture was so many conditioning, and then put on the women, put on the overall freedom. And then I just want to build my own identity, because there's no self in those cultural. And now I realize that many of the culture in the East is actually very codependent. Then I spent 20 years in America. Now, you know, just like if you have a parent, and now the parents is getting divorced, especially right now. And now you actually see the freedom. This is I value so much. You know, so hey, yes, I finally got my identity. But just like last said, you know, and in the meanwhile, you know, my ego grew significantly as well. So now the other day I have a very interesting conversation with my son before we go to bed, and then I just randomly ask him, and then because I was reading a book, I asked him, who are you before you were born? You know, I just, and then my son gave me a really interesting answer. He said, I'm the universe. I'm like, oh my God. Okay, so mom, dad got divorced. So now I'm with my son right now. So I hope I can be in the middle way in the future. Thank you.
May, how old is your son?
11.
11.
Yeah.
He's very wise.
Well, yeah, I don't know. So he just randomly talk about that. And that's really funny. So I'm like, okay, thank you for being the universe. So.
Thank you, May.
Thank you.
Thanks, May. Okay, go ahead, Brenda. In one sec.
There we go. So for me, I think when I was younger, I valued doing things for people, like, you know, doing things for my children or for patients at work or for, you know, just kind of service, basically acts of service. And and then over time, I sort of like, and that was okay, but then I kind of, you know, I saw that the things weren't, people sometimes were resentful for the acts of service they were given, and or uncaring, or, you know, the funny thing, I, you know, is the story of my kids used to, I would put all this food in the fridge and the food would go bad. And then when they went to their friend's house where there was no food in the fridge, they would just fight for the food. But then I realized, I said, what am I doing wrong? And they say, I failed to give them need. And then I let the fridge empty. And then slowly I kind of started reaching a middle path. And also at work, I used to kind of keep giving advice to patients, and they wouldn't listen. And I would just get frustrated. And then I learned something about motivational interviewing, where you actually like engage in the relationship. And so over the course of time, I think what I've moved more towards is sort of valuing the relationship rather than just doing something for people randomly, like what you think is important, but you may or may not be right. and trying to understand what it is they need and communicating with them and seeing if you can kind of reach some understanding, a common understanding of in their relationship. And that acts of service can be part of that, but they're only one small part of that.
Good.
Hernan?
One example I have is that growing up in Chile, my family was Catholic. So we grew up Catholic. I went to a Catholic school. My mother, she practiced. My father, he had Christian values, but he never practiced Catholicism. So when I was around 24, I didn't like Catholicism anymore. I didn't go to church or anything. And actually, I argue in a good way with priests at school, and it didn't fit. But at the same time, I didn't pay attention much. I didn't care much. Then in California, when I was 33, I was doing graduate studies. And my roommate was from Nepal. Very interesting guy, Kishan Cha. He grew up in the mountains of Nepal. So one day, I remember, it was a Saturday, we started talking about religion. And we started arguing, I mean, arguing in a good way, but he had a combination of not only Buddhism, but something very Nepalese, I don't remember. But he was saying things that were foreign to me, very foreign. And I was saying things that, although not a practicing Catholic, was like automatic. I mean, I had a background that was saying things more than me saying things. And this conversation extended with a beer, then another beer, and around 3 a.m. in the morning, we were both quite passionate and stubborn. And suddenly I started looking at him like watching a movie. And then I started thinking of me like another character in a movie. And actually, I remember what he was saying almost faded out. And I told him, Kichan, what do you think that you would be saying if you had been born in my family in Chile? And what do you think that I would be saying if I had been born in the mountain hut in Nepal? And we were silent. And I told him, you know what? This is just a geographic accident. And I remember we laughed. And the next day, I had a different worldview. And what I realized is that the conversation, almost all of it, was like an automatic pipe. And so that changed my view deeply. And it was first time that actually I started paying attention to Buddhism and other things. So it was a personal experience with my friend Kichan Cha.
Wonderful. It's a good story. Do you still stay in touch with him?
No, we lost touch. We kept in touch for about 10 years.
Oh.
And then he moved. He started working in Canon, in the printing company. And he moved and I lost track of him.
Okay.
But actually, now that we talk, I'll try to find him.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, everyone. Just wanted to say that... lately, sitting sometimes in the morning, I've just come to realize that I've spent most of my life trying to get liked by other people and by my family, by my friends, and by other people. But lately, I've been hearing quite a lot of, and then I went from there to not caring at all about anybody. But lately, I've been sitting in the morning, and I've come to realize that I'm developing a sort of empathy for myself. And from there onwards, I'm moving outward. And it's because of sitting that has helped me to move outwards. And I'm seeing people and myself in a very different way. So it has changed me quite a bit to see that, you know, it's not really about me all the time. Whenever I feel like I start thinking that it's about me, I've started focusing my, putting my focus outward at other people and seeing what other people want, what other people desire, need, what are other people's issues. It's not about self-sacrifice or anything, but I do take care of myself more. I have empathy for myself, but I also have empathy for other people. It's almost like saying that I've sort of turned inward. Instead of looking at other people to give me validation, I'm looking at myself to give myself validation. Instead of saying that, oh, I don't have this, I ask myself, do I really need this? Do I really want this? Is this of anything that is of value to me? Is this going to make my life better? And so the way that my whole process of thinking has completely changed. And it has taken a long time, but it has brought about a certain amount of change. But one of the essential questions that I've started asking is this beneficial to me? Is it beneficial to other people? Then I'll move forward. But if it's going to benefit me and hurt other people, then I'm not going to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank you all for your inspiring examples of how your values have shifted and changed. And it, I think it demonstrates that a healthy mind is constantly open to examining its values to see if they are valid or if they're just something we stubbornly cling to. And as you've all noted, our practice helps us with that immensely. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.